This is London. This is London.
The Voice of Russia World Service.
This is the Voice of America, Washington, D.C., signing on.
This is the Dutch World Broadcasting System in Hilversum, Holland, with a relay transmission via Bonaire in the Netherlands and Chile, directed for New Zealand.
This is Radio Prague, Czechoslovakia.
Ici Radio Canada. This is Canada.
Bonjour à vous si vous nous rejoignez sur Radio France Internationale. Il est 5h à Paris.
This is Radio Ukraine International.
This is the English program of Radio Deutsche Welle, Germany's international broadcasting service.
Media Network Plus, produced and presented by Keith Perrell.
Well, it's very nice, of course, to have you with us once again. Last week on the show, we were talking about a new shortwave receiver from Sanjin, the ATS-405. As you're probably aware, and if you'd heard the program, I wasn't totally impressed by it. But today I want to take a couple of moments to talk to you about a Sanjin radio that I was impressed by. It's not a new radio. In fact, it's been out for some time. It's the Sanjin SG721L. Now, if you're trying to find out information about this radio online, it's a little bit difficult to come by. I had heard about this radio, but I actually hadn't really seen it, except for two places, the International Airport in Hong Kong and the Changi International Airport in Singapore, as well as a location in Singapore called Mustafa's Plaza, where they had a couple of them. Well, 2 weeks ago, I decided, well, I'm going to go buy one and see what this radio is all about. Now, this looks just like a small pocket AM radio, you know, the old kind that you would have as a kid. That's what the first thing I like about it, because it is that small. It really is very small. You can put it in your pocket. It covers all the shortwave bands from 5 megahertz all the way to 21.5 megahertz. So it actually has the 60, 49, 41, 31, 25, 21, 19, 16, and 13 meter bands. It also has long wave. So if you're in Europe, you can listen to long wave stations, medium wave, and FM. Surprisingly, many of these small pocket dial type, and I say dial type because there is no digital display on this radio, sometimes they're a little bit hit and miss. But I have to say, I'm rather surprised with this one. I'm surprised at how good it is for how much you pay. Now, this radio I bought here in Taiwan, so it cost me the equivalent of between $15 and $20 US, which is not very much for a small portable radio. It takes two AA batteries and is very light and, like I said, very compact. Tuning to shortwave stations is actually quite easy. I'm surprised at how sensitive this radio is. Now, when I was playing around with it for a week, I didn't even use an external antenna. You can use just the whip antenna, and especially the strong stations like Radio Japan, China Radio International, Radio Australia, and others, come in rather clearly. It has a very small speaker, which is what you would expect on this type of radio, but you can also use headphones at the same time. If you don't want to use batteries, you can also use the AC power supply. The radio runs off 3 volt DC. Now, this is a radio that I would suggest you go and buy. Especially if you're an outdoors type, let's say, that likes going camping or hiking or even cycling. Because it is so small, you can put it anywhere, really. So when I was cycling this week, I actually brought it with me a couple of times and stopped off at a few places along the bike trail here in Taipei and powered it up, had a little bit of a break, and listened to the BBC at Radio Australia for about 30 minutes. So the radio is perfect for that. It's the Sanjin SG721L. Now, you might find it a little bit difficult to come across. The other places that this radio is being sold, other than Singapore, Taiwan, and Hong Kong, are Vietnam, Cambodia, Burma, Laos, and you can also find versions of this radio in places like Malaysia and also China. So if you are looking for the kind of radio that you can go camping with that's very light, not worth too much money, so if you lose it or damage it, you're not going to be sobbing, I would suggest you go and buy this one, the SG-721L. Now, this is not the kind of radio that you could compare, let's say, with an ATS-909X or a Texan PL-660 or PL-880. It's not in that league at all. This is a very simple dial shortwave radio. So if it's just to listen to news and information, this is the way to go. It's a nice little compact radio. On a scale from 1 to 10 for price, well, I would definitely give it 10. For reception quality, I would give it about an 8 because it does perform much better than some of the other small size radios out there. There's one a few years ago that I reviewed. It was a Texan DR11. And I thought that radio was pretty appalling. This one, however, I do give it high marks. But like I said, the sound quality, of course, is not going to be as good as a larger radio because the speaker is rather small. But if it's just for talk, hey, you know, there's no problem there. And you can also use headphones as well. So do check it out. Sanjin SG-721L, the 12-band world receiver.
The Spectrum Monitor is a monthly electronic magazine covering shortwave, amateur radio, scanning, satellites, Wi-Fi, and vintage radio, which is available for any device capable of opening a PDF file.
Category 105, which is PDF 222 journal.
Speed 220, Category 105.
The Spectrum Monitor also covers amateur radio satellites, maritime and military monitoring on shortwave, reviews of receivers, scanners, and software used for shortwave, and more. Annual subscriptions for 12 issues is only $24, with individual monthly issues available for $3 each. If you're already a subscriber, you can renew your subscription by clicking on the Sign Up for 2015 button. MasterCard, Visa, Discover, and PayPal are accepted. For more details, visit our website at www.thespectrummonitor.com.
We're going to stay on Sanjin for a moment, but this time we're going to head to the archives. In 1990, when Jonathan Marks was hosting Media Network on Radio Netherlands, he received a tape from the late David Monson, who passed away in 2010, about Sanjin. Now, David had been living in Taiwan for many years, and David prepared a report for Media Network on his little visit to Sanjin. So from the archives, let's take a listen to it right now.
Radio Netherlands, not national, but international broadcasting direct from Northwest Europe.
Thank you very much.
If you listened to BRT Brussels in the early 1980s, you may remember a presenter on their English service called David Monson. David is always full of surprises, but I was taken aback when a call came in from Taiwan recently. It was David, and he'd been round the Sanjin factory to find out more about this manufacturer of shortwave receivers. It's one thing to test their products here in Hilversum. Quite another, it seems, to go in search of where all this stuff is made.
In fact, Yungo City, site of the company's corporate headquarters and four assembly lines, is just a jolting 20-minute bus ride from the centre of the Republic of China's capital of contrasts. A company of contrasts in a capital of contrasts. Because who would have thought that in this unpretentious building, undistinguishable from the drab monotony of all the others in this metropolitan wasteland, more portable world-band receivers are produced than anywhere else in the world? Looks are deceiving, though, because behind the facade is an ultra-modern factory, entreed by way of a double door, bottlenecked by boxes full of electronic paraphernalia. Four assembly lines that churn out between 50 to 60,000 shortwave receivers a month. That's more than 700,000 a year. And that grossed their manufacturer a staggering $27 million US dollars in 1991 alone, a $6 million increase on the sales figures in 1990. Appropriately, the hurly-burly of world events were, for a large part, responsible, as globe-trotting sales manager Albert Chen told me.
Before the Gulf War, the people in the United States seems to be not so understand about the what is multi-band radio. But I have to say like this, after the war, the people of the consumer in the United States, they were educated what is multi-band.
Of course, another war, half a century ago, did the same for international radio when folks back home sat with their ears glued to valve-driven mastodons listening to reports from some of the greatest war correspondents of all time. Walking the line, or rather down the assembly line at Sanjin, here's a familiar label, and very Dutch. So we're now going down another assembly line. It's less noisy here, Mr. Chen.
Yeah, of course.
This is a unit that you turn out for Philips, right?
Right. This is the only joint venture model with Philips.
The only multiband radio that you make for Philips?
Yes.
What model is this?
AE3805.
Do these receivers get exactly the same treatment as the one that we saw upstairs? The same brutal shock treatment?
Sure. Everything is the same.
But there's another new product that hit the market a couple of months ago.
We think the multiband radio is normally carried by the traveling people. So you cannot find any similar item from the market. This is our concept of the marketing. We have to survive a lot of competition from Hong Kong or sometimes from Japan. So we have to survive. To survive, our philosophy is that we have to make our things unique.
A digitally tuned model is on the drawing boards, as is a smaller version of the popular Sanjin ATS-808, which has sold more than 100,000 units since 1989. While Sanjin isn't shy about statistics, they would only tell me that the new model would be more compact and include some more refined features than that at present. I'm also able to vouchsafe for the fact that although a portable world-band receiver with synchronous detection is very much on the company's mind, and has been for some time now, it won't be on the drawing boards in 1992. Nor, for that matter, does the company intend to move into the satellite dish market. Market response, worldwide, seems to indicate that there's still a lot of room for development in the shortwave radio business. Anyhow, I've just coasted down another flight of stairs, and the unprepossessing grey-haired gentleman in a factory jacket, framed in a doorway on the landing, is introduced to me as none other than C.S. Yang himself, the Japanese-trained electronics engineer who founded Sanjin just 16 or so years ago now. Half a world away, a South African appliance manufacturer brought out the first direct linear readout shortwave radio for the mass consumer market. It was left to people like the Yangs, father and son, to capitalize on the idea. Simple FM-AM radios were first off the line. Today, production is spread over a surface area of 25,000 square feet with a combined personnel of 360, 256 of whom are employed on the production line itself. The units arrive in Yungho after sub-assembly on three fully automatic surface mounting lines in Xiongho, where PCB alignment on a single line is also carried out. To get back to figures, in less than a decade, the company has captured a third of the European market, and more than a quarter of that in the United States for this kind of radio equipment. Ironically, though, here in the Asian heartland, the market's still wide open, despite reasonably, and I quote, a good customer or two in Indonesia and other parts of Southeast Asia. Well, here's Chen again.
Far East country is not like European or like USA. We got not so many shortwave listeners.
And that was our archive look at Sanjin from David Monson. That was produced back in 1990. The last voice that we heard there was of Albert Chen, who is still at Sanjin today. This is Media Network Plus coming to you from PCJ Radio International. The Governance Institute wants to take the names and details of company directors off the ASIC database in Australia to protect people's privacy and safety. But journalists like Ben Butler said this would cripple both day-to-day and investigative journalism. Richard Ady put the question to him, why is this so much of a concern?
The problem is that they're proposing to make the database useless, or largely useless, for the purposes of journalism. That's really it in a nutshell. They want to strip from the database the former names, the date of birth, the place of birth, and the residential addresses of every single company director in Australia, which there's a very large number of.
The Governance Institute is saying what it's concerned about are two things. One is identity theft, and the other one is assaults on security of company directors. And they point to a specific example of a company director finding union members on his lawn last year.
Yeah, so that's basically all they've got. And that's anecdotal. So they say that a protester told him that that's where the information came from. I'd point out that this company director's address information is also available on the land titles database. And perhaps that's their next port of call, is to strip people's names from land titles, which would be a very interesting proposal. In terms of the other issues about identity theft, they don't have a single skerrick of evidence that this has ever happened using the corporation's database.
So why do they want it to happen then?
When I've put it to them and asked them about this, asked Judith Fox, who's their sort of head of policy, why do you want to do this? And her response is, well, you know, those things. And I'm saying, well, you don't have any evidence of those. And they don't really have a decent answer. All I can think of is that really what it's about is shielding company directors from unwelcome scrutiny, which is applied often through the media.
All right. Well, let's talk about how journalists use this information now. So people like you, what are you doing with it?
The first and really most, one of the core things we're doing this is making sure that we're identifying the right person. So we will search companies or search names of company directors, find out who the directors are, who the shareholders are, and match that with the information we have from outside the company's database to make sure that we're actually talking about the right person, which is a really basic and fundamental part of journalism, is actually getting the name, getting it right in the first place. So we use this to do that, and it's one of the main sources of identifying information in Australia. An enormous number of people have companies and are company directors, all sorts of people that you wouldn't necessarily expect. Tony Mockbell, the Melbourne crime lord, was a company director for a while. And we use this information to track down those people, make sure we're actually talking about the right person, not, you know, for example, defaming someone who's also called Tony Mockbell, who's a completely different Tony Mockbell, who's completely innocent of anything.
So that's nailing down identity, but there's more to it, isn't there?
That's right. And the other thing we do, and again, it's about cross-referencing between databases largely, is track down assets, what people own, where they own it, what they've got, what they're doing, what are their roles in society. So we cross-reference, for instance, against the Land Titles database, which is another important database that shows who owns what property in Australia, and cross-reference against international company databases so that we can see that, you know, someone who's a company director in Australia is also a company director in Hong Kong or Singapore or some other jurisdiction, and we can see that a company over there that appears unrelated to them is actually them.
How often is this used by journalists? How often do you use it, Ben?
I use it every day. Every day. At vast expense to News Corp, I must say, because ASIC charges absolutely piratical fees for access to this data, and that's an argument for another day, perhaps. But every day, multiple searches on people to make sure that I'm talking about the right person and link the dots together correctly.
Can you give me an example or two of a big story that wouldn't have been possible without this kind of information?
Yeah, look, one of the really interesting things that people may not realise is that in coverage of, for instance, the Trade Union Royal Commission and issues around trade unions that's going on at the moment, the identities of people who run a lot of these labour hire companies that have been in focus recently are quite difficult to discern from the outside. And it's really only using the company database that has made it possible for people to link up those dots and make sure and say, well, that's the same person who's run a couple of different companies and that's them, and we know that that's absolutely 100% that person who's been named before the commission or named in a document or something like that. So that's a really one that, you know, I think people who view companies solely in this sort of grand corporate context of ASX-listed companies might not understand, is that companies can be just one bloke and a piece of paper, who runs a shonky little company that needs to be found because it's, you know, important for some other reason rather than an economic reason. Another example that sort of goes to some of the same areas is earlier this year I worked on a story involving a home loan fraud ring, and we had a group of people running a large number of companies involved in this fraud ring, and they used a lot of different names, but it all came back to the same addresses and the same or similar birth dates. And without that information, we would not have been able to show that they were the same person using different names.
Okay, I can see the utility. But as you would know, the Productivity Commission is proposing something called a Director Identification Number, a DIN. And the Governance Institute says if ASIC, if these come in and ASIC does its job properly, it'll be possible to use that DIN to identify and locate the company directors anyway.
That's complete nonsense. The Governance Institute has misrepresented the position of the Productivity Commission by omission. So the Productivity Commission proposes adding a DIN, which would be useful, to the database. The Productivity Commission has never proposed removing any information from the database. There is a problem with the integrity of ASIC's data when it comes to names. They don't do any checking at all at the moment, and they should on the way in, and that's what the Productivity Commission proposes. But taking information out is simply not proposed by the PC. The other issue is that, okay, so now I can identify, using under the Governance Institute's model, I can identify people within the company's database. But what have they taken away? The ability to actually go out and test that information against other information in the real world from other sources. It's a proposal for company directors to disappear into a company's bubble. That's the only place where it'd be any use.
This is an issue, isn't it? Because the government is preparing, it's started down the road to selling the ASIC registry, more or less.
Yeah, so the Governance Institute has actually been pushing this wagon for a little while. They wrote to the Assistant Treasurer, or Treasury, actually, to be precise, in January, first proposing this idea. And now that the ASIC sale is sort of progressing a bit, they really opportunistically leapt on that and said, oh, well, you know, this data is going to go into private hands or something like that, and there's a sense of urgency. They're attempting to manufacture a crisis. Well, you know, the problem with that is that under the government's model to sell the ASIC registry, the data will in fact remain in the hands of the government at all times. So it's a furphy.
What do you want the government to do?
Well, working journalists are preparing a letter at the moment, which we plan to send to Assistant Treasurer Josh Frydenberg, who's responsible for this area, and we call on him to just simply rule it out. It should be thrown in the bin. The Governance Institute says they want to start a conversation. I think that conversation should stop.
So, as you will remember, Ben, the government didn't exactly closely listen to the concerns of journalists and the wider news media when it came to data retention. How confident are you about this?
I think this is such a wacky, wild, crazy idea that it would be a brave government that would, or brave, but which by which I mean silly, of course, that would seriously consider this. Because in addition to journalists, this data is actually also used widely by law enforcement agencies, and cutting them off is a whole other kettle of fish, and also runs contrary to the recommendations of anti-money laundering and counter-terrorism finance authorities around the world, who recommend that more information about who owns what should be available, not less.
That was journalist and columnist Ben Butler speaking to Richard Aidy on why the ASIC database in Australia is important. You're listening to Media Network Plus, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. And coming up in a few weeks, we're going to be taking a little bit of a vacation, and we have some special programs lined up for you then. We'll give out the details on next week's program. But now it's time to turn our attention to propagation and what we can expect and what has been happening. Here's our propagation editor, Glenn Hauser.
Keith, from IPS in Australia, the global HF propagation forecast is normal at all latitudes through July 17th. Space Weather South Africa says through July 18th, magnetic conditions will be quiet, shortwave fade-outs unlikely, MUF unstable. Met Office UK says solar activity is expected to remain at low levels, the risk of moderate class flares only 5%. Peter Coleman of the Czech Propagation Interest Group says the geomagnetic field will be mostly quiet on July 17th, 26th to 29th, August 3rd to 5th. Quiet to unsettled on July 18th, 22nd to 25th, August 1st and 2nd. Quiet to active on July 19th to 21st, 30th and 31st. SWPC in Boulder says geomagnetic field activity is expected to be mostly quiet through July 30th, with ANK indices of 5 and 2. Quiet to active levels July 31st to August 2nd, with minor storm levels expected on August 1st, ANK indices reaching 25 and 5, and again on August 7th. Solar flux rising from 100 July 18th to 22nd to a peak of 120 July 27th to 31st. Bill Hepburn's VHF, UHF, microwave DX maps at dxinfocenter.com show extreme tropospheric ducting all week, all over the Mediterranean, which leads some FMDXers to vacation in the Balearic Islands. Likewise, still all around the Arabian Peninsula. But where are the FMDXers there? Many other areas in the North Temperate Zone enjoy enhanced tropospheric ducting, but at less than extreme levels.
Well, that's all we have time for. Our email address is mnp@pcjmedia.com, mnp@pcjmedia.com. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well, hoping to see you all again very soon. 73 and 88 to the ladies.